I'm Mo Frechette, one of the partners at Zingerman's in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And I'm here with my founding partner, Poppy Saginaw, who was with Ari Weinzweig, started Zingerman's in 1982. Zingerman's began as one shop and now has seven different businesses. Paul's mentioning that it's now eight different businesses. And we're going to talk a little bit about the growth of the business from its early days till now. So, Paul, why don't you start off and tell us a little bit about those early days. How long did it get, you know, kind of take from concept, hey, I want to start a deli, to like opening your doors and selling sandwiches? And what were those first days like?
Well, Ari and I met working in a local restaurant in Ann Arbor. And I was the general manager, and Ari started as a dishwasher there, actually. I left and started a retail fish market in 1979. And then in 1981, there was a building across the street that had been a corner grocery store that opened in 1902. And the grocer retired. And
was it one family that had run it during that whole time?
Yeah, the Dyroff family had run it during the whole time, and the grocer lived upstairs with his family. It was, you know, corner grocery store, little meat counter, penny candy, ham hocks, deep-fried pork rinds, collard greens, and cigarettes. And he retired. The man who was our landlord across the street at the fish market bought it and wanted to open a restaurant, which he opened a cafeteria that lasted about 6 months, and he was hemorrhaging money, and he knew that I had been in the, he closed it. He knew I had been in the restaurant business. He asked if I'd like to open it with him as a partner, and no, I didn't. he was a terrible businessman. He was a pretty good visionary, but he was a terrible businessman, but he was very nice. You know, Ari and I had been talking for about 2 years about the fact that Ann Arbor did not have a good corned beef sandwich. And we started collecting articles about different food stores and delis. And so I said, I don't want to open this with you, but I'd like to lease the whole building from you with all the equipment the way it is. He had just closed one day and everything was there. And he said, okay. And so I went over to Ari's apartment, and I said, I found the location that we can open this deli in. And we sat down, and with a Smith Corona electric typewriter, because there were no word processors in that day, we typed out our vision of what we wanted to do. And really what we wanted was we wanted a great corned beef sandwich. We wanted to have a specialty food store that was going to gather the finest food products from around, and then smash down in the middle of it, we would have this busy, bustling sandwich shop, and we would have these overstuffed sandwiches that, you know, you had to take two hands to pick up, and when you bit into them, the dressing would roll down your arms, and that's what we wanted to do, and we did.
Did you keep the cigarettes when you started?
We kept the cigarettes. You know, behind the counter, there was a window with a windowsill, and then there was the meat slicer. And I remember that the windowsill would be, have, you know, just lined with cigarette burns, because you would be smoking your cigarette there. But when you were going to slice the meat, you would put it down. Then we wanted to become more sanitary and professional, so you could only smoke in the kitchen. we sold cigarettes and smoked them there. But we were one of the first restaurants in Ann Arbor to go with no smoking. so we may be slow, but we're not stupid.
When you guys started, you know, nowadays the delicatessen at the corner of Kingsley and Detroit is kind of known for lines out the door and around the block, because it's such a small space, you can't fit a lot of people in at one time to go shopping and placing orders for sandwiches. You guys typed out a business plan in an evening, and then you opened up shop not too long after. Were there lines out the door from the get-go? Did you find that that happened pretty soon, or what was it like in those early days of opening?
They were pretty heady times. We were busy from the get-go. We were right. Ann Arbor longed for a good corned beef sandwich. And when we opened, there was me and Ari and two employees. And so when our friends would come to congratulate us on opening, we would throw them an apron and get them to come behind the line. And our corned beef supplier would deliver at lunchtime and then park his truck and come in.
That was Cy Ginsberg.
Cy Ginsberg.
Still the corned beef supplier today.
Still our supplier almost 28 years later.
Yeah.
We were busy and there was pretty steady growth, and it was hard to keep up with.
Yeah. And when you would also go to the suburbs of Detroit to buy bread, and I remember you had a car that would go make that journey. That was quite a special little car.
I had a 1973 Citroen SM with the Maserati engine. And because volume was low in those days, I could fit all the bread we needed in there. And because I was going in at 4 a.m, I could go 135 miles an hour down M14 and really cut time down on the trip so I could get back and help Ari open.
Yeah. And then it was, you know, that bread was the, you know, kind of the foundation of sandwiches, which were the foundation of the business. And then about 10 years into the business or so, you decided to change the bread radically, which also kind of changed your entire business. Can you describe a little bit about what happened around that switch in bread?
Well, we believed that the bread was what was going to make the sandwich, and we found what we believed was the best bread that we could get, fresh. But the baker wouldn't deliver it to us, so we had to drive in every day. And you know, there was there was dozens of jobbers who, you know, had bread routes and would pick up from all different bakers, and that would make it easy. They would bring it to you, but this particular baker didn't deal with any. And so we had to pick it up ourselves, which we didn't want to do. But one thing I learned from that lesson was that what I believe is one of the differences between businesses that are successful and people that are successful and those that aren't, are that the successful people and the successful businesses do all the things that the other people don't want to do and don't do.
Because they're difficult.
And we didn't want to do them either. It wasn't fun to get up that early and go in and drive and get the bread, except sometimes when you were going 135 miles an hour. But it was necessary. And so, you know, it was, but, and we, you know, we were, we had a belief that everything can be improved. And so every year we were just trying to look at products and how do we make this better? And we know there's better out there. And the bread was the best we could find, but the quality was inconsistent. We often had problems with it, and we worked with the baker trying to get him to improve it, but he really didn't have any interest in that. So we decided that we would, if we wanted to get better, we'd have to make our own bread. And we also decided that if we did, we would set that up as a separate business, so that we had someone who, number one, we could provide the opportunity for ownership in the business, in the brand, and we would have somebody who was passionate about a given product and would focus just on that, and we weren't going to continue to complicate what we were doing, and that we would be customers and suppliers of each other so that there were real market pressures, and we thought that that was a better way to do business.
Yeah, and so out of that, in 1992, came Zingerman's Bakehouse, which was a standalone business owned by you in partnership with a guy named Frank Carollo, and we started baking bread in Ann Arbor. And this is around the time when there were a few artisan bake shops appearing around the country, kind of returning bread baking to what was happening for years in France and Italy and Spain, although kind of dying there as well. In the same way that we see, you know, artisan chocolate makers today, this was a very trendy thing to do at that time among some people. But it was a really hard business to run. The hours are terrible. There's a lot of delivery involved. There's a lot of, you know, it's low margin for a and heavy product that you got to move around cities and get to people's homes quickly. And then one of the things we found baking is that it takes a long time to make really good bread. You can talk a little bit about like some of the rise times and of the best breads that we're baking over at Zingerman's Bakehouse.
You know, our partner, Frank Carollo, who is our master baker, when he talks about it, he says that for him, time is not a dimension. Time is an ingredient that he's putting in the bread. And our farmhouse bread, depending on atmospheric conditions, will take anywhere from 18 to 24 hours from mixing until it's coming out of the oven. And in the same way with wine or cheese, where over time you're going to develop flavor and texture, that's exactly what you're doing with the bread when you're allowing it to naturally ferment and naturally rise.
You know, from your time at the fish market where you had a partner to the opening of Zingerman's Delicatessen with Ari where you had a partner, then the bakehouse with Frank where you have a partner, all along the way you're kind of... your businesses have been partnerships as opposed to starting a new business and getting managers to run them. So there must be something in that appeals to you and you think it's a good way to run a business. What is it that strikes you about partnerships?
Well, I think that if you have an owner who is responsible for operations and is on the premises most of the time, that you have a much higher chance of having a high energy level, a high level of quality, and that there's a difference between having a sense of ownership, which you can have wonderful employees that work for you, and let's say at mail order you weren't a partner, and you'd been there for 10 years and you come in every morning and you believe it's yours and you fight just like it's yours and you sweat everything. Let's say you're going to bed on Sunday night and you have $2,000 in the operating account and you have a $10,000 payroll on Monday morning. You might say, wow, I feel badly for Ari and Paul. They're really good guys. I hope they can figure this out, but I got to go into work at 5 in the morning, so I'm going to bed. That's a pretty good sense of ownership. True ownership is, shit, what am I going to do? Because, personally, you don't want the embarrassment of not making a payroll, and it really feels different. That's kind of simplistic, but we wanted people to have real ownership. We wanted... not a sense of ownership, and we wanted them to be able to build some wealth and be part of a good brand.
Yeah. Do you have conflicts with that kind of brand, though, where it's like your original idea, your original feeling for this organization, what it represents, is not carried out well by these partners who now have a somewhat equal say in things?
No, we never have any problems at all. Yeah. We have all the problems that every business has. I think that one thing that makes us different is that we try to bring those problems out in the open, and we have a process and a forum, the partners group, where we can hopefully bring those issues and hold each other accountable to the principles that we say we're going to operate by.
Yeah, and the... And some of those principles, can you lay out a couple of those for us? Because that's one of the things that guides the company day in and day out.
Certainly, we operate on a written, agreed upon set of guiding principles, which you could define as the rules of engagement. They're the rules by which we're going to relate to each other within the organization, to our customers, to our suppliers, and to the larger community, and they're important in two specific areas. They're going to set the standards for the level of excellence within the organization, and they're going to define how we're going to the culture of the organization. And if they're well written, then it's a promise that the leadership makes to everybody, saying that that this will be the reality within this organization without exception. And as leaders, if we keep that promise with the people that work with us, then we have the, you know, this wonderful, wonderful asset, which is we'll have their trust. And if they trust in the leadership, we'll be able to accomplish some really wonderful things. If we don't keep that promise, we squander that capital, we lose their trust, you know, we'll be the same as all the other middling businesses around us. So it talks about, you know, it identifies when we talk about the kind of food that we're going to sell. Great food. It's we define it as traditional. We define it as full flavored. We don't sell, you know, we don't go after fads. And it's important that the quality is clearly defined so that the person who's in charge of the cheese department or the cheese cave believes in the same level of quality as the purchaser, because for the cheese manager, this is the best you could possibly find, and it is at its perfect rightness, and this is when I'm going to sell it. And you might have a purchaser that says, well, this, I found some that's almost as good and it's 20% less. And so you can have a conflict there if you're not clear on defining what quality means. It also talks about that we're going to, you know, we're going to be take an active part in the community, that we're going to take significant action and contribute to the social and the cultural and the educational vitality of the community from which we draw our profits. It talks about that we believe in education as a worthy end in itself, and that it's important that we are always educating ourselves and that we're a learning organization. It talks about the level of customer service that we're going to give, which, you know, we want to wow people. We want to service the hell out of them. We want to make them feel that they're the most important part of our day, because I don't know, maybe this is different here in your new city of New York, but in Ann Arbor, I know that nobody gets up in the morning and says, if I don't get a $15 sandwich, I'm going to kill myself. And we have to give them a really good reason to come in, and having this extraordinarily high level of service is one of those things that's going to get them coming back.
Thanks very much, Paul.
Well, thank you.
Sharing a little bit of the legend and lore behind the scenes at Zingerman's Delicatessen.
Today's program was brought to you by Hearst Ranch. You can find this and other Heritage Radio Network specials at heritageradionetwork.com.